KPFT, collective not-for-profit media for social and economic justice. Online at houston.indymedia.org.
Hello, everyone. This is Courtney with Houston Indie Media, and I am so excited to be with you here today. In the studio, we have Rachel, we have Gloria. On the boards today, we have Jacob. And you guys, this is a really great show, so sit back and relax and get some information. Here at Houston Indie Media, our motto is don't hate the media, be the media. And the purpose of that motto is to empower everyone to use their own personal voice. Today, I would like to use my voice and these sacred airwaves provided here for us at KPFT by the community to sort of take the role of a community educator, because there's a story that I want to educate people about if they don't know about it. So if you did know, guess what? We all here today are about to teach you about some really important things. And the title of today's lesson is going to be Dead Man Waiting. So locally, there has been a Pulitzer Prize winning columnist. Her name is Lisa Falkenberg. She writes for the Houston Chronicle, and she has done a series about a gentleman that we're going to be speaking today about. His name is Alfred Dwayne Brown. And I'd like to read an excerpt from one of the articles that Lisa wrote. The Harris County prosecutor stood before 12 jurors, pleading with them to kill Alfred Dwayne Brown. And for a while, the 23-year-old Brown sat and listened, just as he had for days, to lawyers and experts and witnesses calling him a murderer capable of a brazen, callous crime, shooting Charles R. Clark, a veteran Houston police officer on the verge of retirement who was just trying to stop a three-man burglary when his aging pistol jammed. The store clerk, Elfrida Jones, who was killed just days after returning from maternity leave. Finally, Brown raised his hand in court like a pupil in class, jumped to his feet, according to the Chronicle archives, blurting out the messages that he'd been telling officials all along. "Excuse me, I didn't rob nobody. I didn't shoot nobody," he said in a shaky voice. "I didn't do this crime, man." Judge Mark Kent Ellis told him he'd have to stay silent if he wanted to stay. And he did. Stone silent. Even days later, as the jury in the presence of extra bailiffs sentenced him to death. That was in October 2005. Brown went to death row. Brown went to death row. He kept claiming he was innocent, that he was at his girlfriend's apartment that morning when some guys he knew from the neighborhood tried to rob a check cashing store and ended up committing a murder instead. So with that, we're going to start this little education session. And with me, I have master political educator Gloria Rubeck. And I want to start with you to really educate people. First, if you maybe you're new to Houston or new to the world, Gloria, where is death row? And can you describe what it's like for people that reside on death row?
Death Row is about 75 miles north of Houston, straight up the East Tex Freeway, Highway 59 or 69 or whatever they're calling it now, in a small town called Livingston. If you go the same distance up 45, you'll come to Huntsville, where the death house is, where they kill people, but that's not where the men live. The women are in near Waco. I forgot the name of the little town. But the men are in Livingston. The Polunsky unit, I remember when they built it, it's a supermax unit. And when they built it in the early 90s, there was actually talk of moving the men to death row because they were running out of space where they were. I think Anthony Graves, who was the 12th person exonerated from death row, described... When somebody asked him what was it like living on death row for 18 years, and he said, hell. And that's exactly what it is. It is hell. No matter how good you are or how bad you are, as far as your conduct on death row, you're in permanent solitary confinement. And that doesn't mean a cell with bars on the doors. It means a solid steel door. So you're really entombed. this tomb that you're in has a window up by the ceiling that's, I think, 3 inches tall and a couple of feet wide. But you have to roll up your mattress and stand on it, or I guess if you're young and strong, you could pull yourself up on it to look out. So the men on death row have no contact with anybody except guards. Their tray of food is shoved through a slot in the door. They go shower, I'm not sure how often, maybe every other day. And they go to recreation a couple of times a week. But they go to recreation alone in another cage. If you have indoor recreation, you're in a cage inside. If you have outdoor recreation, you're in like a dog run. So you're so isolated. And I've read a lot of the psychiatrists and psychologists' reports on solitary, and they said nobody should ever be in solitary for over 14 days. The men on death row have been in solitary almost 16 years. And many of them are just so mentally ill that it's really criminal to lock somebody up and drive them insane. And, of course, the people that came in with mental issues are now full-blown mental cases. And just one example that people find very hard to believe. One of the men, Andre Thomas, who was sentenced to death, who had mental issues before he ever got there, at two different times plucked out each eyeball and ate them. I mean, how can you even think of that? Other people have slit their wrist or something and taken their blood and written on their wall of their cell before they were being executed, I am innocent, or I didn't kill that man. It's hell.
Okay. And I wanted to paint that picture because that's where, you know, maybe just imagine your friend down the street, a guy you went to high school with, somebody that you knew, Alfred Dwayne Brown, just imagine him like that. He was in death row. And he spent 10 years of his life there. Mm-hmm. Can you talk to us about how it all happened?
Oh, boy. Actually, unfortunately, his case isn't an isolated incident. I can think of so many cases where the cops pick you up based on who knows what. The court-appointed attorney doesn't do squat. The DA hides evidence that would show you're innocent. And it's all legal. And I just read something. Legality and morality do not shake hands in a courtroom. That was in reference to the Angola 3, but it's really in reference to almost anybody that walks in a courtroom. So he always said he was innocent. He'd spent the night at his girlfriend's, Erica Dockery. She went to work, and he called her from her landline phone to her job. She knew it was him because her name came up on the caller ID. And they were talking. This was at the same time that three people were robbing the check cashing place and killing two people. Why his court-appointed attorney couldn't find a court record, I don't know. Except that the DA had it.
Right. So one of the interesting things about this case that really compelled me to talk about it are a couple of things. One, there was a police officer on the grand jury.
He was the foreman.
He was the foreman of the grand jury. So if you don't understand, you know, that would be a direct conflict of interest when you are prosecuting the death of a police officer. Mm-hmm. All right. The next really huge thing was that evidence was actually hid. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, but before I talk about that, I want to tell you what this cop did as foreman of the grand jury.
Okay, yes, tell us.
Because talk about wrong. I don't know if it's legal or illegal, but Erica was subpoenaed to go to the grand jury, and she told them, you know, I was talking to him on the phone. This cop put her in a little room. He said, no, you've got to tell what is right, that he confessed to you. And she said no. So he locked her up for 120 days, I guess during the term of the grand jury, and told her she was going to stay locked up. And this is a mother of three kids who had two jobs. You're going to stay locked up until you give the right testimony. So after, a couple of months, I'm sure by then she'd lost both jobs, she said, okay. She said, I can't be without my children. So she changed her testimony and said, yeah, he told me he did it. Then, after the grand jury was over and they indicted him, they charged her with perjury for lying. She was wearing an ankle monitor. I can't remember if they sent her back to jail. I don't remember. But put her in all this legal trouble because she did what they told her.
Yeah. And so, yes, that's very key. Also, the psychologist on this case, which is near and dear to my heart, the psychologist on this case sort of fudged the psychological exam so that it didn't show his true IQ.
Uh-huh.
Made him more intelligent than what, because he had issues with developmental issues.
Right. He couldn't read.
Right.
When he got to death row.
Right. So
couldn't read his mail.
Right. So that was another thing. But the thing that just gripped me was the investigator on the case hid evidence.
Mm-hmm.
Can you talk about that?
Well, last year this investigator, this policeman, said he was cleaning out his garage and found the phone records. And then I read he was the investigator on the case. And then I'm hearing, well, the DA said, oh, that was inadvertent. What a mistake that was. Well, BS. They knew about the phone records. But they got their man, so what did they care? I mean, that happens all the time. Ask Clarence Branley.
Yeah.
And this happens all the
time. All the time. And that's why I want us to know, because Alfred Dwayne Brown is, like I said, that's somebody you went to college with, somebody you went to high school with, that's mm-hmm. your friend from around the corner. He's any other guy that you would know. And this happened to him, you know, and so if it can happen to someone like somebody you would know, that means it's not far removed from happening to you.
Absolutely.
And I want to sort of wrap this up a little bit, and I want to leave us with some words. The first word is Alfred Dwayne Brown. If you don't know the story, please take the time, look it up. Lisa Falkenberg with the Houston Chronicle, some other keywords. She's got a great series that you can read about. This man, Alfred Dwayne Brown, was convicted with no physical evidence and with an alibi. And he went to death row, the place we talked about from the beginning, for 10 years.
Mm-hmm.
So he was
in 2 years in the county awaiting trial. So he's locked up for 12 years. He has a 13-year-old daughter.
He hasn't seen.
Mm-hmm.
So, ladies and gentlemen, folks out there, you've just been schooled. We just had a political education session here for you today. I want you guys to, you know, this story had a happy ending, but how many people does it not have a happy ending for?
Absolutely.
So, again, I implore you, take the time to learn about Alfred Dwayne Brown. See if you don't know Gloria. You know, you can find her on Facebook and find out some of the things that she works with if you want more information about injustice that's around. And I'm just really humbled and honored to be able to bring, you know, share a little tidbit of this story. And we have about 1 minute. Go ahead.
Alfred Dwayne Brown is the 13th person to be released from Texas death row. He is the 154th person nationally to be exonerated. The thing that just burns me up is that the district attorney will not say he's innocent when she knows darn good and well he is. But that would entitle him to $85,000 a year for every year he was wrongfully locked up. So she said, he's still our main suspect, and we're looking for evidence that we can take him back to trial on. Well, boo. That is just so wrong.
It's incredibly wrong. And with that, I'd like to kick it over to Rachel Clark.
Exactly. And speaking of, this is something that is not, unfortunately, rare. It's very common. We're going to talk about another similar case, this case going back over 40 years. 43 years ago, deep in rural Louisiana, Albert Woodfox, Herman Wallace, and Robert King were silenced as they were trying to organize and expose segregation, systematic corruption, and horrific abuse at a former slave plantation that was later converted to a prison known as Angola. Just as the ongoing nonviolent hunger and work strikes at that time were catching the attention of elected officials, these three men were accused of murdering a prison guard and placed in solitary confinement. The penitentiary's case was riddled, much like the case we just heard about, with issues ranging from evidence not matching or not being supportive, the convenient loss of DNA evidence, and also the complete disregard of multiple alibi witnesses. As a result, King, Wood, Fox, and Wallace, as I said, they spent decades in solitary confinement. King was released in 2001, Wallace in 2013. Now, the case with Wallace is especially tragic because he only spent a very few days being able to enjoy his freedom before he succumbed to advanced liver cancer and passed away. Earlier this week, a federal judge ordered the release of Albert Woodfox, the remaining member who is incarcerated. We were hoping tonight to be able to say that he was released. However, that was blocked by the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals, the same Court of Appeals that also this week upheld that Texas's ban on abortion providers is also legal and can be upheld. So boo, Fifth Circuit. But can you maybe, Gloria, as a longtime abolition activist and prison rights activist, maybe briefly sort of paint the picture as far as give us some more details about the specific case that resulted in the Angola 3 and also the circumstances that they were organizing against at the time that these very spurious charges were brought against them?
You know, one thing that, well, first of all, the three of them were members of the Black Panther Party. Mm-hmm. They had formed a chapter of the Black Panther Party in Angola, and the conditions in Angola were like something from Gone with the Wind era. They were horrific, and they were educating people and organizing. The other thing that happened in their case, which is so typical, I can think of Todd Willingham, who's now dead, but they used a jailhouse snitch. They promised to give him a carton of cigarettes every week if he would say that he saw them kill his guard. And like a fool, he said, oh, sure. It's interesting that the wife of the guard, well, for years now, has said that she knew it wasn't those three men that killed her husband. She issued another statement yesterday. She said, I'm tired of the state of Louisiana dragging me through the episode that was the worst thing in my life that ever happened to me, my newlywed husband being murdered, and talking about the Angola 3 when they know they didn't kill him. She said, I'm sick of it. I know they're innocent, and Albert Woodfox needs to be released today. So it's been a long struggle, and like everybody on Texas death row, the Angola 3 were in solitary the whole time they were locked up. Albert has been in solitary 43 years. That's like being locked in your bathroom or your closet, maybe. So it's a case that has gained a lot of political support. It's a case that's been proven in court over and over again. And the judge has actually ordered Albert released several times, but the state of Louisiana kept blocking it. So this was supposed to be the final ruling. Now,
it's an emergency block. So
yeah.
What does that mean?
So it means that I think July 7th, the state has to turn in all their lies. Then the attorneys for Albert have, I think, till the 1st of August to rebut them. And then there's going to be oral arguments in the Fifth Circuit in New Orleans on August 31st. And I plan to be there because I've sat through some of those hearings in New Orleans, and it's just such an education that when you talk about it, the criminal justice system, criminal is the right word because so much that happens is just criminal. I was hoping at 1 o'clock today he would walk out. And as soon as I left death row, I got on my phone to see if it had happened. And
I think a lot of us were waiting for that. Yeah. I was actually kind of hoping that this also would be able to be a celebratory story, much like the one that Courtney just covered.
Right.
That being said, how is it that the other two members of the Angola 3 were released earlier? Under what? How was it that Louisiana was able to not continue to block?
Well, I don't think Robert King was even at Angola when the guard was killed.
No, he was not.
How they brought him into that, I don't remember now. But he's been out over a decade and has spent night and day fighting for his two brothers. Angola never treated Harmon for his cancer,
no,
which is criminal. And we were all so excited when he got out. And then 2 days later, he died.
Mm-hmm.
I went to his funeral at a black community center in New Orleans, and packed with people. Oh my gosh. Black Panthers from all over the country were there. His casket was draped in a Black Panther Party flag. And the speakers were just so touching. I don't think there was a dry eye in the place. Parnell Herbert, who actually lived in Houston for a while after Katrina, organized it. He's back in New Orleans. I don't know if they let Herman out because they knew he was fixing to die.
I know part of it had to do with the fact that there was not a female jury, so they were able to argue that it was not a jury completely of his peers. But then I don't know if the reason Louisiana failed to block a second time was because of his very serious medical condition, which, as you mentioned, the prison system failed to treat or do anything for. And you're not the first person who I have heard saying that the state of Louisiana, in fact, killed Herman.
Oh, they did. Just like they killed David Ruiz in Texas. David found out right before he died that he had cancer, and he'd had it for 3 years, and Texas TDC never told him. And he was the one that filed the landmark lawsuit to reform the prison system.
Oh, yeah, just real quick for the sake of situational awareness. I don't know if I told you, Rachel, I don't know if you you know yet, but the prosecutor who convicted Anthony Graves
was
disbarred.
Today.
Yeah, I was kind of actually amazed to find that out, because you really have to screw up real bad to get disbarred as a prosecutor in the state of Texas.
You do. You have to prove it was deliberate, which is what Brown would have to do to show that Rizzo was the DA in his case, to show that he deliberately hid those phone records. And that's hard to do. But what Anthony did, and bless his heart, I'm so glad that he has came out with a head on his shoulders after 18 years, but he filed a complaint with the Texas Bar Association.
Yeah,
and they disbarred him. And what I would like to see is him locked up. But that's a clear violation of Supreme Court rulings, the Brady ruling. You don't hide exculpatory evidence. You share it.
Right. But then the other issue is, of course, here in Texas, we are one of the few states that does not have a court. We do not have a public defender's office. Essentially, sooner or later, if you're a practicing criminal attorney within the state of Texas, you do not have the training, the heart, the passion, or the funding. But yet you, when your number comes up, you get to defend these people because oftentimes their families do not have the means to provide for private attorneys and the costs. Exactly. So what else do you think that people need to know about Albert Woodfox? I also know when I did speak with Malik, who is one of the founders of the Angola 3 Support Committee, he actually helped organize and provide support for the Common Ground Collective on the heels of Hurricane Katrina, in spite of being held in solitary confinement. So can you maybe speak a little bit about what you know of him as a person, or some of the other ways he's still been able to be engaged with the community and continue his activism in spite of
Malik
being confined for 43
years?
Just
one of these rare people. I first met him in Berkeley, where he had moved to San Francisco for a while. And I met him there, and then he wound up moving back to Louisiana, became an activist in Louisiana. And the last hearing at the Fifth Circuit around the Angola 3, he was there, and we spent some time together. He has just taken this case, the heart and soul of it, to everybody he can find. He's written about it. He's been in films about it. And just been one of their main backers. In fact, I think the first time I ever heard of the Angola 3 was from Malik, maybe 15, 20 years ago, at a Workers' World Party conference. He came to talk about the Angola 3. So he has been one of their longtime supporters. But for people who don't know about him, Google the Angola 3. Maria Drummer has a wonderful newsletter that she puts out regularly that I've been getting every day this week with updates on their mm-hmm. case. And now that there's a timeline, at least we know that our oral arguments will be at the end of August. And then, I don't know how long it'll take for them to rule, hopefully not more than a month or two. And then we'll celebrate.
Well, yes, and of course, you know, the clock is ticking just in terms of, unfortunately, this is a case that is 40 years old. And also, you know, there are issues, there are ongoing issues with the passage of time as far as, obviously, Albert's getting older and also the witnesses and things mm-hmm. even are obviously moving on and so forth. And so with the passage of time, it always gets more precarious. So we are hoping we can celebrate very soon. Also, another way to educate yourself on the Angola 3. The Last Slave Plantation is a documentary that came out about 5 or 6 years ago. You can see it on YouTube.
Right.
You can Google it online. It is a very, very well-done documentary that I encourage listeners out there to check out in terms of just educating yourself. Gloria, as you mentioned, the Angola 3 is not something that obviously gets a lot of corporate attention. This week, I'm seeing a little more traction than I did previously as far as mainstream media talking about
even
it.
Even a big article in the New York Times.
Exactly, which is very refreshing, but historically it's something that's gotten a lot more traction outside the U.S. than in the U.S.,
right.
even though this is a Louisiana case.
Absolutely.
Is there anything else you want listeners to know before we close out our
check
show?
Check us out on Facebook. It's the Texas Death Penalty Abolition Movement. We're going to be in the Acres Home Juneteenth Parade next Saturday, not tomorrow, but the next Saturday, and then we're going to be at a Juneteenth festival in Fifth Ward after the parade. Then we'll all be sunburned and pass out. But we meet at the Shape Center first Tuesday of every month. We've got all kinds of activities going on, and there's a role for anybody, whether you want to make a phone call or write a letter or just buy somebody a magazine subscription.
Lots of ways to support.
I remember years ago getting somebody, USA Today is the cheapest paper. He said, thank you. I didn't know if there was a world out there because he had no visits, no TV, no newspaper, no. So there's lots of things people can do.
Okay, thank you so much. And Courtney, do you want to go ahead and say a last few words?
I just think this has been extremely informative. This came together so well. I'm excited about it. Again, I'm going to say his name again, Alfred Dwayne Brown. Look it up. The Houston Chronicle, Lisa Falkenberg. Those are some places for you to start. And, you know, I have to continue to say, don't hate the media, be the media.
Thank y'all.
Thank you. And, of course, we also encourage everybody out there, like us on Facebook, Houston Indie Media. Look us up. Like us. You can hear past shows. And we are grateful to be able to keep doing this week after week. Peace.
And hello to everybody on death row.
Tap your toes to music legends during the Sounds Like Houston Thursday Concerts presented by U of H Downtown at Discovery Green this spring. Every Thursday night through June 25th, enjoy free outdoor concerts showcasing the best musicians from Texas and the Gulf Coast. This series offers something for fans of every music persuasion. Austin's own Roxy Rocca headlines this week with dynamic soul and funk, featuring infectious grooves, a blaring brass section, and an over-the-top frontman. Making waves on the Houston music scene is local band and opening act Electric Attitude with a high-energy funk fest. Concerts begin at 6:30 every Thursday night. Most street parking is free starting at 6. Picnics, blankets, and lawn chairs are welcome, but glass containers and alcohol are prohibited. For more details on the Sounds Like Houston Thursday concerts presented by U of H Downtown, visit discoverygreen.com.